Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Hey, everybody. I got a fun one today. You know, for a change. David Letterman is my guest. David Letterman, and you will enjoy it. So there. So much bleak stuff happening, and I thought I'd give you a bit of a respite from the bleak stuff. But first, some bleak stuff. The day after the tragic shootings in Boulder, just a few days after the tragic shootings in Atlanta, there was a Judiciary Committee hearing, my old committee, on guns. These hearings, of course, are scheduled well in advance. Nevertheless, here's Ted Cruz at that hearing.
Every time there's a shooting, we play this ridiculous theater where this committee gets together and proposes a bunch of laws that would do nothing to stop these murders.
Again, Cruz knows that this hearing was planned well before Atlanta and Boulder. And here's the thing. I was in the Senate in 2017 on the Judiciary, and I don't recall having 346 of these hearings because that's how many mass shootings we had in that year in the United States. Now he goes on.
What happens in this committee after every mass shooting is Democrats propose taking away guns from law-abiding citizens because that's their political objective. But what they propose, not only does it not reduce crime, it makes it worse.
Okay, a couple things. The only guns we keep talking about taking away are the kind of assault weapons that the killer in Boulder used, a semi-automatic assault weapon. We don't want to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. You know, we do want background checks on people so that non-law-abiding citizens, maybe you've had a history of domestic violence or of mental illness, citizens who shouldn't have guns. We want to make sure they don't have guns. But let me ask Ted Cruz something. When was one of these mass murders stopped by one of these law-abiding citizens with a gun? Well, yet another mass shooting prevented today in a McDonald's when a madman with an AR-15 was gunned down by several law-abiding customers who routinely carry their AR-15s to the McDonald's for just such an occasion. You know, if that had ever happened once, we'd hear about it from Ted Cruz every time there's a shooting, wouldn't we? That's nothing like that has ever happened. Okay, voting rights. In Georgia, it will now be a crime to bring water to someone waiting in line to vote. Say, on a hot Georgia summer primary day, waiting for hour upon hour under a sweltering sun in line in a black neighborhood where they deliberately have only one polling place. If you gave someone in that line a bottle of water, well, be prepared to do some hard time. And how about letting the state legislature overrule the state secretary of state? That way, you know, instead of asking Raffensperger for the 11,870 votes, Trump could have just gone right to the Republican Speaker of the House. 11,870? I'll give you 100,000! Republicans across the country have over 250 voter suppression bills in over 40 states. Republicans are saying, we just can't win unless we cheat. We have to pass Senate Bill 1, the companion to H.R. 1 in the House, or, at the very least, a more narrowly tailored bill to tell Americans what exactly is going on here. And that will mean addressing the filibuster, which I've talked about here and will continue to talk about. But the villain here is Chief Justice John Roberts, who cast the deciding vote and wrote the opinion on Shelby County, which eliminated the Section 5 preclearance requirement of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Section 5 prohibits certain states and local governments that have a history of discrimination against protected minorities. It prevents them from implementing any change affecting voting without receiving first pre-approval from the U.S. Attorney General or the U.S. Circuit Court for D.C. And John Roberts got rid of that. Shame on him. Now, we will be revisiting that also on this podcast. One last thing. Mark Zuckerberg testified to a House committee Thursday of last week, along with the chief executives of Google and Twitter, about Section 230. Section 230 was part of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, when the internet was in its infancy. Section 230 provides immunity to website platforms from third-party content that they post. Now, basically, it says these platforms are platforms and not publishers of content and therefore can't be held responsible for that content. And, of course, this is a complicated issue. We have a First Amendment in our country that is sacred and essential to a free society. But when this was written in 1996, its authors could hardly envision all the ramifications of these platforms having no responsibility for the pernicious and dangerous content that they very deliberately post to keep people on the platform. Because keeping people on Facebook to be advertised to is their entire business model. I've discussed this a little before, and I will do another podcast on this very soon, because this is why we had people storming the Capitol on January 6th. It's the reason we have two universes of information in this country, information and disinformation. Here's the thing. Facebook uses algorithms designed to keep you on Facebook. This is AI, artificial intelligence. Their AI knows you better than you know you. It knows every click you've ever made. It knows every click that every one of its 2 billion users has ever made. Every one of its 2 billion users gets their own feed designed with one and only one intention: to keep you on Facebook. Their AI is getting constantly smarter. It knows what to feed you to keep you on Facebook. That's all they do. Facebook doesn't really do anything else. So this idea, oh my gosh, we have no idea how to control disinformation people are getting on our platform. We have no clue who gets QAnon bullshit. Yes, you do. In fact, that's all you do. That's the only thing you do. Your only business is feeding the right content to each user at exactly the right moment to maximize their time on your platform. You do nothing else. And guess what, Mark Zuckerberg? You can't police yourself. So a lot of heavy stuff going down, and I just touched on some of it. But let's have fun. Let's have fun. I am a great admirer of David Letterman. As you will see, we are friends, and I hope that you will enjoy this one. You know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. that means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled BABBEL.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I remember a joke you told very early on, I think probably in one of your first, or maybe the first Tonight Show appearance on Carson, where you talked about being a weatherman in Indianapolis?
Indianapolis, yes, sir. WLWI.
Right.
Channel 13.
And I believe the joke was about something about, as weatherman, I was just one heartbeat away from being anchor. That's the joke, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't, but thank you.
You don't remember that joke, huh?
I don't remember it.
Wow, that to me was like a defining joke when I saw that.
I remember Al, that at one point I had worked at the television station 3 or 4 years during and out of college, and I realized if I didn't do something, I was going to spend my adult life in Indianapolis, where I was born and raised. So I started looking around in Broadcast Magazine. They would have ads for jobs in the back. And I answered an ad for, I think, KSTP.
Oh, Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, yeah.
Yeah.
Edina, I believe it was in Edina. And they were looking for a weatherman. And so I sent them a tape. And they said, oh, sure, this is fine. Come on up, and we'd like to talk to you. So on my day off, I flew from Indianapolis to Minneapolis,
okay,
and went in, and they had me do a live audition or a taped audition in their studio and so forth. Then I talked to the general manager and on and on and on, and everything seemed to be fine. And the money was to a penny, exactly what I was making in Indianapolis. So I thought, okay, well, you know, that's not a factor. That's, you know, it's at least it's not less. And I'm now moving from a position of weekend weatherman, which I was in Indianapolis, to full-time weatherman. And I started to think about the weather is different in Indianapolis than it is in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way,
was that intimidating?
Yes, it was intimidating. So I'm now rolling the facts around. Same money. People would be really, really expecting me to know what I was talking about, which is intimidating, because I didn't know what I was talking about even in Indianapolis, but nobody really cared.
A lot of weathermen, a lot of TV weathermen are, and women, weather women, are meteorologists.
Well, now, sure, now. I think somebody stepped in and said, you can't give this to high schoolers and weather enthusiasts. You have to have licensed meteorologists, and you have to have the radar, and you have to have team coverage.
What's funny to me is that you were saying, like, I'm going to get stuck here in Indianapolis as a weatherman. Or it was more about Indianapolis than about being a weatherman. Because you were just perfectly, what you're looking at is another weatherman job.
Yes, that's right. I knew if I didn't make a move, the inertia,
oh, I see,
which was building up around me, would prevail. So on the way home, they're driving me from the station in Edina,
mm-hmm,
back to the airport, and I see these row after row after row, multi-leveled row after row of slat-like fences that were along each side of the road that took you to the airfield. And I said to the driver, I said, geez, what is this mile after mile after mile of the fencing going up? And he said, and this was in September, early October. And he said, oh, those are the snow fences.
Right.
And right then I said to myself, I'll be staying in Indianapolis.
You're intimidated by having a report on snow or having to live with the snow. Which was it?
Well, I just recognized I wasn't up to the task of having that responsibility. And I, you know, it would take me 2 or 3 years to learn the names of the communities and the people who wanted to, you know, lining up, wanted to.
I think you were selling yourself short, frankly. I think you could have handled it, but nevertheless, whatever you did, you made some good choices along the way.
Well, I don't know. We make choices, don't we? Now, here's what I've always been curious about you, Al, because you and Tom, my rough understanding of your history at the Comedy Store was you guys were there for a time, but left the year before I arrived.
That's exactly
so
right.
So I only knew of you, but I didn't see you and Tom together on stage at the Comedy Store. Now, did that in fact happen?
Exactly. You're exactly right. Franken and Davis had been Comedy Store regulars. In fact, Franny was a cocktail waitress. My wife was a cocktail waitress at the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
And she came east with me when Tom and I got the job at Saturday Night Live in 1975. And we missed you. I think it was just barely missed each other. And so Franny came with me, but my sister-in-law Carla was also a waitress there. And she told me soon after you arrived, she said, there's this guy, David Letterman, who's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
That's very nice of her. But
well, she's got really good taste, my sister-in-law Carla.
So Al, you guys were there for the debut season of SNL?
That's right. We were there the first meeting in the office.
And how did you get the gig?
We were the only writers who were hired whom Lorne hadn't met.
Mm-hmm.
An agent, a William Morris agent, saw us at the Comedy Store.
Who was the agent?
Herb Karp.
Oh, Herb Karp was everyone's first agent.
He said, you guys, I like your material. You're really good writers. Would you like a job writing? And we said, yeah, but we're not right for any show. Because the only comedy variety shows are The Tonight Show. We weren't right for that because it was basically jokes and then some of these Mighty Carson Art Player sketches, which were kind of corny, right?
I think they're purposely so.
Yes. And that was very Carson. So we said that we can't do that. And the only other comedy variety shows that were on were Carol Burnett, which was a really good show. But we were just wrong generationally for the Carol Burnett show, right? And the other show that was on Comedy Variety Show was Sonny and Cher, and that was crap, as you may remember.
Now, had the Smothers Brothers come and gone by then?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got canceled because they were so controversial. Do you remember
that? That's right.
Remember that? Steve Martin wrote for them, right?
Yeah, that would guys would have been more attuned, more comfortable there had it worked chronologically.
Yes. But there was nothing at that point. So Herb said, this is what he said, well, why don't you just write stuff for a show that you would like to be on, that you would like to see? We wrote a news show. It was it was a local newscast the night of the day of World War III. That was one thing we wrote. And we wrote a commercial parody, and we wrote a kind of conceptual film, and then we wrote a sketch that was a parody of Sonny and Cher. And then Lorne hired us based on this package, which was 14 pages long. And the reason I remember this is that there was a period where early on at SNL, and you've read submissions, right? You've read millions of submissions from writers, right? And there are some writers who think that the more they write... the more likely you are to hire them.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does it take you to read a submission before you go yes or no? I mean,
well, I share your experience here, because the longer it is, you even before you take the title page off, you're fatigued. And I could usually tell within a page if they submitted a top 10 list. I could tell by item number 3 on the top 10 list whether we were going to be doing business.
Yeah. And how did this top 10 list get started? How did that start?
Well, years and years ago, I mean, it certainly wasn't a new idea. Every publication in the world would feature, you know, top 10 hamburger recipes, top 10 comfortable shoes, on and on and on. But getting back to you and SNL, so you
well, we'll get back to the okay. But
here's something.
Those weren't funny. The top 10 hamburger recipes. They were handy hamburger recipes. You had the yeah. I mean, what was the formula? What worked on the top 10 list?
Well, I think it was it would take something of the news, something of common awareness in American culture, and it would be top 10 things Dan Quayle did before he had breakfast, and then it would be like that. So that was the staple. And then, you know, we did them and did them and did them and did them to the point where nobody really wanted to do them anymore. And of course, the research said, oh, no. This is the one thing people like about the show.
Oh. Well, you had to keep doing them.
We had to keep doing them, yeah. And everybody just was sick of them by about the first year, because that's, you know, one a night for 240 shows. Well, that's plenty.
I remember you did one for me. Do you remember this? We have a business roundtable kind of event every year in Minnesota, and you did one for me.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
And it was
yeah.
the top 10 bad names of corporations in Minnesota. And it was like second Best Buy and Hormel.
Yeah. Big laughs around the conference.
It was huge. They couldn't believe I got you, first of all. Yeah. But also, mm-hmm. they were 10 good jokes.
Well, we had a pretty good run. And then... Like everything else, you just kind of like, what about top 10 tasty hamburger recipes? You know, you just...
Let me ask you this. Were there... how many on the staff? How many on the writing staff?
Oh, must have been 200-300.
And did you assign like 70 to the top 10? No, I mean...
every day, a topic would be selected.
Mm-hmm.
We would have 3 possibilities. The one we would choose would be Al Franken's top 10 favorite shoes. Okay. And then they would go away, the writers. And then right before the show, we would get together, the head writer and myself and maybe one or two others. And we would collate and just pack together 10. And the problem that we always seemed to suffer was I assumed that the funniest one should be number 1. You want to have to stop the tape and hose down the audience after number 1, because people are laughing so hard as to now not seem human. And then the other theory was nobody ever hears number 1, because the drum roll and the fanfare explosion from the band subsumes number 1.
That's wrong.
So
that's yeah. wrong.
Number one right. rarely was the funniest bunch, but it was a thorn in everyone's side. On the other hand, sometimes likely could have been the funniest part of the entire week.
You are kind of famously, I think, are tough on yourself in terms of, you know, reviewing your own work, I think.
Mm. Well, how many people in the world of comedy or show business who seem to be their own champion that you know?
There are a number, but I
mean, when you and Tom wanted to get something on SNL, did you walk into Lauren's office and say, Lauren, I don't care what you're doing now, listen to this, it's the funniest thing you'll ever hear?
That's how we started every pitch.
Oh, Well, gee, I never thought of that.
Now, we had read through, you know, but I mean, we'd kick ideas around. I mean, you know, this basically the schedule at SNL was Monday, 5 o'clock meeting with the host. Tuesday, you start writing like at 10 p.m., stay up all night, and, you know, you go to read through on Wednesday, and you have this long read through.
Were the read-throughs fun or frightening, anxiety-ridden and tedious, or were they fun and delightful?
Both. I mean, both. They got longer and longer as I was there. When we first started, there were like, I don't know, 10 writers and 7 cast members, right? And cast members, of course, write. And we had Dan Aykroyd wrote a lot, and Chevy wrote when he was there for the first year and a half, and Gilda wrote with Zweibel a lot, and... But that's a limited number of people. And also we worked together, and it got more and more tedious as the cast grew in size. Remember, I was there for the first 5 years from 75 to 80. And we're talking about me now. This is great. I have David Letterman. And but it got a little tougher as these things got longer.
I'm sorry to jump around here, but when did you and Tom... or you start appearing on the show with any regularity?
Basically, right from the beginning, Lorne would put us in dress rehearsal. And if in dress rehearsal, a lot of sketches didn't work and Lorne needed to fill time, he put Frank and Davis in the last 15 minutes of the air show if he needed the time.
Al, that's kind of a cool thing to have because there's no real pressure. And also the opportunity to be heroes.
It was basically we'd go in the dress, we'd do it, and the chances of us getting on were very low. And so, yeah, I guess it was a good place to be. And, man, it was just exciting, that show. Yeah.
Who did you have the most success writing for? Which of the original cast members were you in
sync with? How did this happen? We got a interview with David Letterman. Okay, let's move to you in a while. But I'll tell you, Aykroyd, of course, was someone that Tom and I wrote with a lot. And but you know, that was a great friggin' cast. Everybody was great.
Oh yeah.
Okay, here's something I wanted to ask you about comic sensibility. You and I both share, we both love Bob and Ray.
Oh, Bob and Ray. Good Lord, Bob and Ray.
Yeah. And I remember once you said, I think you said it was either you or you were quoting your dad, that if someone doesn't like Bob and Ray, you have no time for them.
Well, yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, didn't you feel that way, Al? I mean,
well, first of all, I don't know how many people listening to this know Bob and Ray. These guys were 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and they're radio comedians. But Carson loved them. You saw him on The Tonight Show a lot. And you saw him on your show a lot. And Tom Davis and I just loved them. And, of course, Chris Elliott is Bob's son.
Bob or Ray, no one ever knew the paternity there.
I remember Tom and I came on your show, and we did a bit that was very Bob and Ray. The French restaurant, and Tom played a guy that opened a fancy French restaurant in Chadron, Nebraska. And I introduced him as Pierre Lefranc, and then... he said, well, yeah, you know, it's a pleasure to be on here. I go, okay, Pierre, you don't sound like you have a French accent. Oh, no, I'm from Chadron, but I went to a fancy French restaurant in, took a trip to Houston and went to this great French restaurant called A Bientôt du Soir. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, I don't know. So I decided to open a fancy, I loved the food, so I opened a fancy French restaurant in Chadron, and I brought the menu, and I said, okay, now, what does menu actually mean in French? I know it's a French word. What does it mean? And he went, list of food. Okay, now, that's as Bob and Ray as you can get, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So about a week after we did this, there was a Letterman Show Christmas party, and I see Bob is there. And I went up to him and I said, you know, Tom and I did this. Oh, he said, I saw that piece. And it was great. And I said, well, you know, it was really an homage to you guys. And he said to me, uh-huh, you didn't say so.
Oh.
No, it was a joke.
I see.
But, I mean, it was hilarious. I just laughed so hard. Yeah. Uh-huh. You didn't say so.
Pretty good Bob, by the way. Well, I my acquaintance with Bob and Ray, NBC Radio, back in the days when radio was a different kind of thing, they would have a service on the weekends called Monitor, and it was NBC Monitor. Oh, yeah. And they would have half-hour shows. They would have hour shows. It would be news updates. It would be interviews. It would be profiles.
It was kind of a high-tone show, yeah.
Yeah, and it would be all day Saturday and maybe Sunday, I don't know. But every hour or so, they would have a visit from Bob and Ray. Mm-hmm. And they would do several comedy pieces during the day every weekend. And my dad and I became addicted to the little Monitor sessions that these guys did. And that was probably the one thing he and I really had in common, that was where we both enjoyed it at the same measure.
And so I had an emotional thing for you as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So Bob and Ray, as always, they were always more than just guys that were funny, but God, were they funny. And then I remember they worked for Dick Cavett when he had his daytime show, and Ali Ballou and all of that.
Ali Ballou here.
Yeah.
And winner of 11 Diction Awards, two of mm-hmm. which are cufflinks.
Al, this is a remarkable impression.
I did a lot of listening to Bob and Ray, believe me. Yeah. And for my listeners here, what you can go to YouTube and listen to them. And mm-hmm. I would Slow Talkers of America.
Oh, the Slow Talkers of America. Oh, my goodness.
Tell us your name, please. Harlow. P. Whitcomb. And where are you from? From Glens Falls. New York. New York. And what do you do? I am the president and recording... Secretary. Secretary.
The nice thing about the team is they would switch off. One guy would be the stooge one time, and then the other guy would be the stooge the other time. And it always worked.
Man, oh man, oh man, oh man. They were funny. So
there. Right. And not worried about... will this get a laugh? Not worried about taking their time, but just two guys in suits, absolutely steeped in confidence that their stupidity will out.
Yes.
And it was delightful. Chris Elliott, well, like you said, it was Bob's son, and Chris Elliott was on our show many, many years, and one of the reasons we had any success at all was Chris Elliott.
He did the guy under the stairs. So that was his character?
Yeah. And many, many other things. But he was just to have the genetic influence of Bob or Ray around was great fun.
Yeah. And just to have Chris Elliott, brilliant, brilliant comedian, hilarious on your show, brilliant in movies and in TV. And like Bob and Ray... has that willingness to take his time. And you know, you were talking about on your show, you had patience. And, you know, I was a guest on your show a number of times. And I remember, if you know, I would do Leno, right? And I would do some other talk shows. There weren't many at the time. But I sort of remember preparing my stuff that on the other shows, it was like, okay, get to... you know, joke in 15 seconds, 30 seconds. And you, I just felt so relaxed with you because I'm a little bit of a slow talker, I think. And I would develop stuff with you. And you were absolutely confident that things would work out okay all the time. You were not worried about getting a laugh every 15, 30 seconds.
No, it's because of, now that didn't hold true across the board, but if I was dealing with somebody like yourself or you and Tom Davis, then, and Andy Kaufman was the other one, you had consummate confidence that you guys knew what you were doing. And, you know, it's like the self-driving car. It was great because not only were you guys great guests, but it was great fun for me as just somebody who liked what you did to watch it unfold. I remember the first thing that I saw you guys do on Saturday Night Live was you got my attention. And it was so you, it was the Franken and Davis show. Mm-hmm. And the voiceover announcer, the legendary
Don Pardo
introduced it. And it had to every outward trapping, like a big important here we got something.
Yeah,
Frank and the Davis show, and one week it was sponsored by the Communist Party,
working and for you in Africa.
Yeah. And I just thought these guys have nothing but guts, and I that doubled me over.
Yeah, and thanks for having us on. And you know, it's unusual for a comedy team to come on because the
team that weighs the same.
That was one of the favorite things I've ever done. Tom and I came on your on the show, and we pitched that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to appear as the comedy team that weighs the same.
Yeah,
and Tom and I were within about 8 pounds of each other. And so that we worked very hard to get exactly the same weight.
I had no idea you actually had to achieve a steam bath, running, push-ups, sweatpants, anything to get to the same
that
weight.
That was me. I had to lose weight, and Tom had to gain weight. Mm-hmm. And we decided to do this a few weeks before, like 3 weeks before. And I didn't check in with him until like a few days out, and he hadn't gained any weight.
Well, there you go.
And he, you know, Tom was pretty slender, and he just went, well, how do you gain weight? I don't know how to gain weight.
Yeah.
So I go, well, eat waffles, you know. And so, well, we got exactly the same weight. And so we did a weigh-in. We wore robes, mm-hmm. and underneath we had Speedos.
Yeah,
we did a weigh-in. We weighed exactly the same. And you asked us if there are any funny stories from being the comedy team weighs the same. And, well, yeah, we just went to a state fair. And you know the guy who guesses your weight? He saw us coming, and he couldn't believe it.
Wow. Yeah.
That was the kind of joke that you and I like.
In a world which one would think there's room for all manner of comedy, would anybody do that or that kind of bit today? The comedy team that weighs the same, you're not going to see that anywhere now, are you?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of people doing very conceptual comedy, so I'm not sure about that, but you just don't see many teams. There was another joke in this where you go like, has any other comedy team weighed the same? And I said, well, you know, Stiller and Mira claimed they weighed the same, but they never proved it. We're going to take a short break. We're with David Letterman, and we'll be right back with David.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with David Letterman. Oh, I know. I wanted to ask you about something. In 1985, SNL had kind of an off year. And I remember getting a call from the TV critic of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And she said to me, why don't you guys do risky material like Letterman does? And I said, well, you know, what are you talking about? What does Letterman do that you consider risky? And she said, well, the monkey cam.
The monkey cam.
And I just said, now the monkey cam for my listeners, you had a chimpanzee, you put a TV camera attached to his head in a humane way. I mean, it was fine. And he came out on a tricycle and then he got off the tricycle and he climbed up on the lights and you would cut to his camera and then cut to the wide.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, for the first time anywhere, the late night monkey cam mobile unit, Zippy. Paul, come here, Zippy. Zippy, come on over here and sit down, buddy. Sit down and we'll take a good look at you here and... Now, come on, can you come over into this chair? Come on, Zippy, come on over here, buddy. All right, go over and see Paul. Go say hello to Paul. Paul, call Zippy over there.
Zippy. Come here, Zippy.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, it was hilarious the first time, but like everything else, we you know, did it 1,000 times, and
it was funny every time.
Well, it was funny until Sandra Bernhardt was a regular guest on our show because she was edgy and provocative and amusing, and so she was like she fit our guest requirement perfectly. And popular. And she came out and then we turned the monkey cam loose on her and the monkey hopped up in her lap and bit her. And
was that the last one?
I've not been bitten by a monkey, but I don't want to be bitten by a monkey. And she reacted like a woman who had been bit by a monkey. and she hopped up and down and was shaking her hand and screaming. And now the monkey is terrified. And so we have to get the monkey wrangler out there to subdue the monkey in a humane way. And I think that was the end of the monkey cam. But
I think that might have been the end of the monkey. Do they?
No, the monkey still works. Monkey had his own show at Fox for a while.
Okay.
The poor deer was rightfully upset with us.
Well, anyway, I told this critic, that's not risky. That's sure fire.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm explaining this to a TV critic.
Yeah, I've just substantiated that. Yeah.
Okay.
You're exactly right. I'm going to step out. I'll be right back.
David? David has stepped out for a moment. I'm sure he'll be right back with some explanation.
Okay, I'm back, Al.
Well, that was quick. What was that?
Yeah.
That was a drink.
Well, a couple of days ago, I broke my nose, and now I'm kind of suffering the after effects of that. But that's another podcast.
How did you do that? I know it's another podcast.
It was a hammer mishap.
So are you, like, handy? Are you a guy who uses a hammer a lot?
Yeah. During a Writers Guild strike years ago, I took the time off and built my son a treehouse.
Well, that was a good thing. See, that's the kind of thing people should have been doing and should be doing and are doing during COVID. They're doing stuff like that, learning carpentry.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that. And then I put another level on it. And now it's three stories. It's a pretty massive structure. And because when I was a kid, I had a treehouse and I loved it. And my friends and I would hide in the treehouse after school and we kept a Playboy magazines up in the treehouse and we would look at pictures and we would be... every now and then we would get a hold of alcohol and take it up to the treehouse. And so I assumed that every kid wants a treehouse. So I built this monstrosity that's now listed on Century 21. And my son and I, in the years that the treehouse has been up there, which is 20 now or more, he and I spent two nights in the treehouse. That was it.
Well, that is okay. How badly did you break your nose?
Enough that I had to excuse myself to take care of an accumulation of snot.
Okay. All right. You're the first guest who's done that.
Well, I was hoping I would make some sort of impression on your audience.
Steve Allen.
Yeah.
I loved Steve Allen. I know you did. There were a number of things you did that were so, I don't want to say you stole from Steve Allen. You didn't. But
no, we did. We absolutely stole from but I will say that as much as I love Johnny, when I was a kid watching Steve Allen, there must have been something about what he was doing and the age I was watching that seemed to be just perfect. And we took many, many things from what he used to do. And God, it was, I think you and I are talking about the same shows.
Oh, well, like the Velcro, I mean, this is what you did that was so reminiscent of him. the thing where you put Velcro on your chest or wrapped yourself in Velcro and were kind of jumped off a trampoline onto a Velcro wall.
Right.
And stuck to it.
Yeah, that's correct.
And the fizzies too, right?
Well, the fizzies, I think Steve Allen was dunked. I don't know. Something about tea. He was covered in tea bags he did something where he was immersed in a container of water and it was either tea. He made his own tea or something. And so from that, I was in a suit of fizzies, which I don't even know if people know what fizzies are now. I'm not sure I know what they are now.
Well, it's onomatopoeia, or pia, I guess, which is the fizzies are exactly what they sound like. You put them in water and they fizz, and they're flavored.
Oh, they were flavored. That's right.
It was a drink. It was like a drink, fizzies.
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. Alka-Seltzer.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it was Alka-Seltzer. Okay.
It was an early. we thought we had a medical breakthrough. So we had the tank of water and the suit of Alka-Seltzer, and Steve O'Donnell, our head writer at the time, was going to try it out in rehearsal.
Steve.
Yeah, very
brilliant.
Funny kid.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So he gets in the tank, and there was something about the fizzy component of the Alka-Seltzer that subsumed the oxygen in that area. And he nearly suffocated. So just as he's about to lose consciousness, he indicates, get me out of this. And I think when we did it on the show, I had to have an oxygen mask on.
Well, I would think that, I think it's CO2 that comes off.
Yeah, something like that. But it eliminates the breathable air. Or makes it dense with CO2, so you have nothing to breathe.
Yeah, you're breathing CO2 is basically, and you can't do that for
you
too
can't
long.
Do that. And it's, again, it's like everybody's having a good time till the head writer is dead.
Oh my God, I did not hear that story.
Yeah.
Oh my Lord, that's funny. So speaking of writers, just Jim Downey, let's talk about him. Brilliant, brilliant writer that wrote for you for a number of years, but also, you know, was a SNL writer.
Jim Downey, we talk about the World Championships of Comedy. He also would be on the podium. Lorne Michaels, at a certain point in his SNL leadership, decided to step away.
Yeah, that was 1980. The first iteration of the show with Lorne was 75 to 80. And then I left and came back in 85. I was a Lorne again writer, is what we called it.
So he was gone, and many of his writers, Jim Downey included, and Tom and Max.
Max Bross and Tom Gamble.
That's correct. And others came to our show, which was what a lovely benefit that was. And the head writer was Jim Downey. And again, just a 10-second chat with Jim was maybe the funniest thing that you would experience all week. It was he was and is still delightful. Is he still on staff there?
No. Jim left about 4 or 5 years ago. Jim and I wrote a lot of the political stuff together, and he always had this. I love this. He said that we should write to reward people for knowing stuff, but not punish them for not knowing.
Yeah, that's pretty high minded and a narrow line to walk. But God bless him.
Well, no, and you can accomplish that, and I really felt that that's what we tried to do all the time.
Yeah.
And also, we tried to be, Jim's kind of conservative, and so we tried to be not partisan. I thought that was right for when we did that in that time. Mm-hmm. Jim wrote probably the sketch that got George W. Bush elected, which was that debate, the Gore-Bush debate, which unfortunately, you know, everybody knew Bush was challenged in terms of language and stuff like that. So you could make fun of that. And strategery, by the way, is Jim Downey's invention. That was not something that Bush had actually said.
Oh, that's fantastic. So he actually never uttered the word strategery.
No. It was like, can you sum up, you know, your campaign in one word? Mm-hmm. It got to Will Ferrell and he went, strategery. And then to... I guess it was Daryl Hammond, was lockbox. And unfortunately, everybody knew kind of the caricature, at least, of W, which was kind of challenged in terms of language and stuff, a little thick, but not the kind of superciliousness of Gore. And I love Gore. I really do. And he's a hero to me, and on climate and on so many things. But I really believe that whatever that was, 500 and some votes in Florida, that debate. I mean, there are a lot of things. Anytime it's that close, there's a lot of things. But I do think Downey handed that election to George W. Bush with that sketch.
I mean, you reference close elections. You yourself are the veteran of that war.
Yeah, I won by 312 votes out of 2.9 million, and it was a long process, which is why I knew all along that the outcomes in Georgia and Arizona just weren't going to change. And, you know, why we went through what we went through was just so ridiculous and sad, really. And you know, I know you care a lot about politics and you care about our country and you care about democracy.
Yes, but that focus has been fine-tuned thanks to my friendship with you. I'm not sure you can tune a focus, but nonetheless, you know what I'm saying.
I think you can. I think that was close to being something people say in English. I remember coming on your show and making the distinction between you and me, saying, I'm a satirist and you're a clown.
I'm a clown. Yes. And I hear that and think of that, and it still makes me laugh. Now, if we can just jump back to Jim Downey. When he was the head writer, he was in charge of hiring people to write on the show. And there was a fellow from Chicago who later went on to be a mainstay on The Simpsons, which many people from SNL and from our show would do. He would send, in those days, postcards to Jim with jokes on them, hoping to be hired as a writer. So Jim liked him well enough. You probably know the man's name. It escapes me. It's
Schwartzwelder?
Yes, sir. That's him. And
John Schwartzwelder.
He invited him to come to New York City for an interview. So after the show, Jim and Mr. Schwartzwelder come into
Schwartzwelder.
Schwartzwelder. Oh, I'm thinking of a different guy then.
Yeah, so Schwartzwelder was horrible. He's not NF.
They
not
come
funny.
Up to my office, and the kid from Chicago is smoking a cigarette, and he's got a cocktail. Now, this is unusual for a writing interview, but nonetheless.
That was him.
Yeah, and I think he had his feet up on my desk, which that was fine. So he leaves.
Big guy, too. Big guy.
Yeah, yes. And yeah. I don't know what his background was, but Jim Downey loved him. And so we're talking, and he said, well, what did you think of him? And I said, well, honestly, he scared me. Jim says, okay, well, we can't hire a guy that you're afraid of. I always admired that. But the joke that closed the deal for Jim, mm-hmm. he sends to Jim on a postcard, and I'm going to use your name, Al Franken's efforts to break every Guinness Book of Record got off to a slow start when his recording of White Christmas sold 40 copies. I always thought, yep, I should have not been afraid of him.
And he became really a mainstay. He wrote on SNL for a season or two, and really great. But he was a real mainstay at The Simpsons, really one of the big powerhouses there. And, brilliant.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what I wanted to add about Jim's tenor.
And well, that's a great story. I never heard that story.
Yeah, pretty funny joke.
Let's see. Worst kind of guest. Who are, you know, you were, how many years did you do? 30 some years, right?
Yeah, 30 something. Yep.
Yeah. After doing, I mean, there must be some, you know, some little commonalities of I'm now out here with the worst kind of guest. What would that be?
Well, in the beginning, it was a flip of a coin because in the beginning, the first couple of years, the first 5 years maybe, there were many, many, many people on the show that I knew nothing about. And so anybody that I knew nothing about, I was automatically timid about because I felt like I will only demonstrate my vast ignorance and make a fool of myself with this person I know nothing about. And so it's hard to say that they were bad guests. It's just that they were in the hands of, to be flattering, a beginner.
Yeah, and then this is the late night show. This is after Carson. You're following.
Yeah,
Carson.
That's right. Yeah, we had to follow Johnny Carson. So I'm thinking, well, if you really wanted to see a show, you'd be in bed by now, and you would have been watching Johnny for an hour. I used to think that Andy Rooney was a bad guest, and you know, he really wasn't a bad guest. He was just Andy Rooney, and I didn't know what to do with him, and I always felt like my responsibility was to try to make something funny out of the conversation. Andy Rooney didn't quite see it that way. He was there. I don't know why he was there, but
did he make observations there? Like,
yeah, he made observations, and I dearly loved the guy because I had followed his career when he was in the old days on network television. They would actually do hour-long documentaries in prime time, and many times Andy Rooney would write and star and host these documentaries. And his wry sense of humor and irony and sarcasm was delightful, irrespective of the topic. So I had great admiration for him, but I just bungled it when he came on. And
so it was your fault.
It was clearly my fault, but you know, like you do in show business, I chose to blame him.
So did you blackball him from the show?
No, he was very good-natured about it. He came back and. I remember on the CBS show, he and I wrestled something that would be near and dear to your heart. So he was in the down position and I was in the up position, and it was the, you know, okay, wrestle.
I was a high school wrestler is what David's for him. Well, yeah, I'm a very mediocre high school wrestler.
I didn't mean to suggest you were in the WWE.
Or that I like to wrestle Andy Rooney.
Yeah, but who was it you challenged to a fight in a parking garage?
Oh, yeah, that was Rich Lowry. Rich Lowry is the editor, publisher, whatever he is, of National Review. And I saw him on C-SPAN, and he said that Democrats were sissifying politics.
Uh-huh.
And so I challenged him to a fight. I called him up and challenged to a fight. He was a little puzzled. He said, where would this fight be? And I said, in my parking garage. We both lived in New York at the time.
Yeah.
And he said, what would the rules be? And I said, well, you know, there are really no rules, but one until someone gives up.
Yeah.
And then the guy who gives up has to give like $3,000 to whatever the other guy wants him to. And he said, can I think about it? And then he called me the next day and said that he had chosen not to.
Now, you wanted that to happen, though, right?
I more or less wanted to shame him for saying Democrats are sissifying politics. It was so funny. Like, I told my son, I think he was like, 15, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I told him I did this, and he goes, oh, God, Dad. And, you know, he said, what if he said, yeah? And I said, I'd beat him. You know, I was a wrestler, you know, I could beat up Rich Lowry. And sure. So we're watching McNeil Lehrer. Jim Lehrer is doing a segment with Rich Lowry. And so I went, Joe, there's the guy I was going to, you know, fight. And he comes in and it just cuts to Jim Lehrer. And he goes like, Dad, he's like 70 years old. And I went, no, wait.
Wow. Now the way that would have happened, the two of you would have fought, you would have dominated, and then the two of you would have become best friends for the effort.
We've actually became good friends. I said, okay, let's go to lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So after he said, I've decided not to. I said, okay, let's go to lunch. Although we completely disagree on politics, but I really like him.
When you were in Washington, did you ever challenge anyone else to a fight?
No. That was inappropriate for a senator.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, you know, I represent the people of Minnesota, and I felt that if I challenged, you know, Ted Cruz to a fight.
Al, do you think that it's possible, and I noticed this with people who would come on my old show, who had been in public office and now out of public office, and were actually able to do more for the good of the populace out of office than they were in. Have you experienced that feeling?
I've done some different kinds of stuff that I couldn't have done in the Senate. That's good. But I have to admit, I love that job, and I miss it.
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't covered the... Are you going to continue doing My Next Guest Needs No Introduction?
Yes. It's been a lovely experience for me. I can't speak for the viewers, but it's been great. It's been great fun. And it's
really enjoy the show. So there.
Thank you, Al. It's fun because you get a chance to with the old show, the interviews were like you do 5 minutes, you do 4 minutes, and then I would always run long about 5 minutes, and that would be it. But here I can just talk all day, and when that happens, you at least for me, you learn things from these people, and every person that I've talked to in this brief run of shows have been people from whom I have learned things about life and their experience. And I find that invaluable. And I keep thinking back to when I was in college, and everybody has an experience like this, that there was a person, maybe two people in the 4-year experience, or in my case, depending on who you believe, 5 years, that they said something or did something that stayed with you and affected the rest of your life. And I keep wondering if somebody in one of these shows that we have done will say something or do something or allude to something that affects somebody watching in that way. And plus it's just fun. You know, it's nothing but fun. It's not every day. And I'm enjoying it a great deal.
Yeah. It's not the pressure.
Yeah, that's right. I feel lucky to be a part of Netflix. They've been nothing but supportive, and it's all been a great experience for us.
Well, what's the name? Netflix? Let me write that down.
Netflix. They get a little cardboard folder. If you order, say you want to watch Dumb and Dumber, you call up the operator, they'll give you the Netflix number, and you tell them, and they'll say, you want Dumber Dumber 1, you want Dumber Dumber 2, you want Dumber Dumber 3, and you get all three.
And they send DVDs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And they will send those out to you. It'll take about 10
mm-hmm.
days.
Uh-huh.
And you have a DVD player?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I do.
Mm-hmm. All right, put them in there. Now, be careful when you're finished, because those discs, when they come out of that machine, are red hot. So remove them with oven mitts.
Okay. Well, thanks for the tip.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Oh, I haven't asked you about Schaefer, Paul Schaefer.
Okay.
Paul, I've known Paul since the first year of Saturday Night Live.
He was also an original on Saturday Night Live, first season veteran.
Yeah, and a great friend, great guy. He took an approach which was the sort of showbiz hipster. Would that mm-hmm. be fair?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He loved show business, and the worse the show business, the more he loves it.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. And it's sort of a thing he shares with Marty Short.
That's right. And many people also.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
When he was a kid living in Thunder Bay, the parents, mom and dad, yes, would take him. There was some resort across the border in Minnesota. Maybe you know what it is. And they would see, you know, big musical acts and big comedic acts from Los Angeles. And then I think they would also take him to Las Vegas when he was a kid. So he was steeped in this particular kind of show business early on. And I think that was the formative times for him, and it stayed with him.
And a brilliant musician. And of course,
a genius, just a genius. And, you know, for like 28 years, he was the musical director for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Orchestra. And I never saw him break a sweat in the 30 years he was working. And the thing that gratifies me about my friendship with Paul, via the show, he had the opportunity to work with people he loved and admired. And he has those memories, and he talks about them regularly. And I feel like, well, geez, I was able to help him do that. That makes me feel good about that relationship.
Oh, my God. He worked with so many iconic musicians that came on your show. And very often he would arrange something where your band would play with them or people from the band. And it was amazing.
He has great stories about one of his favorites was working with James Brown.
Oh.
And he talks at length and lovingly about having James on the show and what that was, and, you know, things that James Brown said to him. And that's just great, you know. And he's a guy who collects stories, and the fact
yes.
that he's got his own encyclopedia of stories makes it even better.
Yeah, and I just mentioned Marty Short, also Canadian. So we're talking a lot about funny
Short.
Canadians.
Yeah.
He's kind of like one of your go-to guests that it's always an event when he's on.
He was great. It was great and is great. And a lot of people would come on and, okay, I can only be here 7 minutes, and I can only be there a minute before showtime, and then I have to leave, and don't touch me, and don't let Dave talk. And Marty Short would come in, and Steve Martin was the same way, and they would come in and they would go over with the writers what they wanted to do, and then they would write it up, and then they would rehearse it, and then they would come in and perform it. And they really committed to being a guest on my show. They all they needed to do was sit down in the chair, but they went beyond that, and people loved them, you know, people like that would do it. And there were quite a few, Bill Murray and Tom Hanks and Steve Martin and Marty. And
well, Steve and Marty have a two-man show. I mean, COVID has put, you know, they can't do it now, but they were touring with the show. Brilliant, brilliant show. But the thing is, the work ethic, both of them, but Steve, it's crazy.
Yes, and I think he, to invoke the word genius, is limiting what he has accomplished with his career. The fact that he has sustained his output and his work and performance at such a high level his entire career, I think puts him in the upper echelons of genius, is what I was trying to say.
No, and you know, I saw their show twice, and I saw it toward the beginning of the run that they were doing, and then I saw it maybe, I don't know, a year and a half later. It had evolved And you could tell, you know, I mean, it just, I loved it the first time, but somehow it got even funnier, which is hard to do. But I saw, oh my God, he just works this every night.
The combination is great. You know, Marty and Steve, they really complement one another. And I saw it once. I was part of it once and just dumbstruck at what they did. And the night that I did the show, I get to San Antonio, and it's 190 degrees, and I'm walking around San Antonio looking at the Alamo, and I go into the theater, and it's about 3:30, and there's Marty, and there's Steve on stage, and you walk out of the blistering heat into the theater, and Marty comes up to me, and he says, I think Steve may be a little anxious today. And I said, oh, good Lord, why? And he said, well, I don't know why, but he has the hiccups. And they won't go away. And he said, it has only happened to him a couple of times in his life. And it's a manifestation of some sort of anxiety. And I said, oh, Jesus. So then I go over and I say hi to Steve. And sure enough, it's and you think of, every now and then you read about a kid in New Zealand who's had hiccups for 30 years. And you think, oh, God, are we on the beginning of this? So we do the rehearsal, and Steve excuses himself and goes back to the hotel. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. And then I've also heard that this is sometimes happens just before a stroke. So now I'm anxious. And so Marty keeps coming in with updates about Steve. And so at showtime, Steve comes back. Oh, thank God. He took a nap, and the hiccups dissipated.
If you read Steve's book, Born Standing Up, you kind of get the sense that Steve is complicated.
But of course, everything comes back to me. And I read the book and I thought, Jesus, I would just get on stage at the Comedy Store for 5 minutes, try out one joke, and then get my two free drinks and go home. Steve knew and was writing and was doing, and I thought, holy God, if I'd known it was that difficult, I never would have left Indianapolis. I'd be in Minneapolis now in a diner doing the weather.
I know, but you worked extremely hard.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
I mean, this is the hardest I've worked in years.
You don't have a late night show, and I know that you probably regret what you did to your family. But Harry turned out pretty good, huh?
Harry's fine. Harry, much to my surprise, is quite fond of the academic pursuit.
Oh, good.
Which I never was. So I'm very, very pleased about that.
Well, yes, you that wasn't your thang, as the kids say.
No, not my thang.
Not your thang. Not my thing. But you did okay. You did okay. And I'm looking forward to the next season. Are you just not going to tape any of these until COVID's over? Or?
We did four the last time around. We did two, and then the virus started to spread, so we shut down. And then we found ways to safely do the remaining two in that little pod of shows. But logistically, it was difficult. As it has been for everyone beyond logistics, by the way.
Here's something I've thought of. Are there more people who don't need an introduction coming into existence than the pace of your interviews? Because
that's a good question.
Is that a question you've asked yourself?
Well, we're constantly in touch with the Bureau of Weights and Measures. And they told us that there are now about 40 people left who actually don't need an interview. That's about 40. You never know what's going to happen, but right around 40 is the number they have.
Oh, that's enough. And then by the time you get through them, there'll be some others.
Well, you don't know. I mean, the number goes up if you count the royal family. But I don't like to put them. I think that throws the index off.
Wow, that would be a good interview, though. The Queen? Really? The Queen?
Well, yeah, the Queen. I'll take all of the Queen we can get, for God's sakes, yes.
I know what I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. I have always considered you a broadcaster. mm-hmm. as opposed to distinct from a late night host. And you're both. But I felt that you were an important broadcaster. And mm-hmm. I think one of the best examples of that was 9/11. I remember I went down to the site, and I remember just a couple days after, and I remember a firefighter who lost some brethren said to me, Letterman has to come back. He actually said this to me. I can't remember how long it was before you did, but you did it. And it was just a very brilliant, healing, perfectly pitched moment in broadcasting history, I think. And
well, thank you.
Yeah, and it was really important, and it was perfect. And I wish I could remember it, you know, exactly what you said. And I don't remember, actually, but I just remember that.
Well, it's nice of you to remember the moment. I don't remember exactly what I said. It was one of those circumstances where if I was going to come back and continue what I had been doing, I knew that this was desperately necessary. And what was needed was some sort of, how do you address it? Do you address it positively? Do you address it regrettably? Do you have a serious or sinister tone about it, or an uplifting tone? And I think it was just one of those moments where I was able to satisfy the expectation. And I don't know what more to tell you about it than that.
Welcome to the Late Show. This is our first show on the air since New York and Washington were attacked. And I need to ask your patience and indulgence here, because I want to say a few things. And believe me, sadly, I'm not going to be saying anything new. And in the past week, others have said what I will be saying here tonight far more eloquently than I'm equipped to do. But if we are going to continue to do shows, I just need to hear myself talk for a couple of minutes. And so that's what I'm going to do here. It's terribly sad here in New York City. We've lost 5,000 fellow New Yorkers, and you can feel it. You can feel it. You can see it. It's terribly sad. Terribly, terribly sad.
I think we went back on the air the Monday after the Tuesday attack. You know, Howard Stern, by the way, was on the air through the whole thing. And I asked him to send me the tapes of that day. And it's fascinating, because in the beginning, it's Howard Stern doing his Howard Stern show. And, oh, something's happened downtown. And then there was a half an hour of speculating what had happened downtown. And then you have the whole history of it there on his show. And I'm surprised somebody hasn't, and maybe somebody has, taken it and used that as the core of a documentary. But I always thought that, and I didn't know this and didn't even think about this till years and years later. And he was nice enough to send me the whole show. And I mean, there's a perspective that was a living, breathing account of that day. And I think that would make a fascinating show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he is a fascinating broadcaster himself, and has
he's wonderful, isn't he? I mean, do you have a friendship with Howard?
Yeah, not a close friendship, but I really like him. I admire, you know, the transition he's made, and he's also an amazing broadcaster himself.
Yes, and a nice fellow.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Speaking of that, you've been incredibly nice to me in so many ways, and I appreciate that.
I have to thank you. Because of you, Al, this election cycle, I knew what to do, and I was able to do it. And I remember it was because of you going way back on Martha's Vineyard years ago at a fundraiser in somebody's backyard. And we got to do that again and again, different places. So I was not afraid when people would ask me if I could participate in things like that. So I did a few things like that for this election cycle, and found it really, really gratifying. So My interest and activity in politics is largely due to our friendship. So thank you for that.
All right, man. Thank you. This is, I think it's going to be a really good one for a change.
I think this is going to be an 8-part thing.
Anyway, so listen, thank you.
Thank you, Al.
We'll edit out, we'll edit this to make you seem funny.
Thank you.
Okay.
You get your work cut out for you there, my friend.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.